Okay, good to Baruch Shavua Tov. I hope the mic is going to work in a minute. Today's shiur is about abortion in Jewish law, people in the cases for induced abortion. The last shiur, this is the second of the series dealing with abortion. In the first shiur, we discussed maternal reasons for abortion, the situation where the mother's life is in danger, and we also discussed the whole debate about personhood. And now we'll go over to the second part, which is dealing with situations when the fetal viability is in question, and the question is if abortion would be allowed. The topics we're going to cover today, Mir Tashem, are non-viable fetus, a fetus which is obviously not alive, Tay-Sachs disease prevention, PGD, which is a relatively new technology to screen out embryos which are defective and thereby implanting only healthy embryos, and of course there's a ethical controversy about these procedures too. And then we'll talk about acrania anencephaly, Potter syndrome, pathology of control, which came up. These cases were dealt with in the last few months. And then we'll talk about harvesting organs from a child that has anencephaly, and multi-fetal pregnancy reduction, dilul ubarim, and we'll finish off with hydrocephalus when there's a dilemma if the feticide or a cesarean, when this decision has to be made, one of the two, and the mother is not prepared to undergo a cesarean. So what should be done? So let's start with a non-viable fetus. Shavua Tov. Come in, you have room here. a non-viable fetus, when there's no heartbeat detected, that's a sign that the fetus is no longer alive, and the pregnancy can then be terminated. Since ultrasound results can sometimes be inaccurate, it's imperative to have the tests repeated and a second opinion sought before deciding on an induced abortion. If all experts agree that the fetus is no longer alive, there's no halachic impediment to perform the abortion. Because if the child isn't alive anymore, of course, there's nothing to prevent an abortion. But what happens when we're dealing with an alive, non-viable fetus? When the fetus is no longer alive, the situation is quite straightforward. But what can we do when the fetus is diagnosed as non-viable, but it's still alive and the parents are under a terrible distress? Can the pregnancy be terminated? And then, how do we define a non-viable fetus? Of course, it means the fetus cannot live, but for how long? A day? A month? A year? And what type of deformations can we look at as being non-viable up to the sense that we can terminate the pregnancy, and when do we have to wait until the child or dies in utero or can be born with the problem they have? The most famous problem which was dealt extensively in the halachic literature is Tay-Sachs disease. And a few words about this syndrome. Tay-Sachs disease, abbreviated TSD, is an autosomal recessive genetic disorder. Recessive meaning a genetic disorder that produces its characteristic phenotype only when its paired gene is identical. Meaning both parents have to be carriers of this mutation in order that the child should get the disease. In its most common variant, it's known as infantile Tay-Sachs disease. It presents a relentless deterioration of mental and physical abilities which commences at 6 months of age and usually results in death by the age of 4. In Orthodox Jewish circles, the organization Dor Yesharim carries out an anonymous screening program so that couples who are likely to conceive a child with Tay-Sachs or another genetic disorder can avoid marriage. And today, Tay-Sachs covers about 15 genetic diseases which are screened, which are prevented by this organization. How does it work? Orthodox Jewish high school students are given a blood test to determine if they have the Tay-Sachs gene or these other genetic diseases. Instead of receiving direct results as to their carrier status, each person is given a 6-digit identification number, and couples can call a hotline. If both are carriers, they will be deemed incompatible. Individuals are not told they are carriers directly to avoid any possibility of stigmatization or discrimination. If the information were released, carriers could potentially become unmarriageable within the community. Anonymous testing eliminates the stigma of carriership while decreasing the rate of homozygosity in this population. Screening for Tay-Sachs carriers was one of the first great successes of the emerging field of genetic counseling and diagnosis. Proactive testing has been quite effective in eliminating Tay-Sachs occurrence among Ashkenazi Jews, both in Israel and the diaspora. In the year 2000, it was reported that in the United States and Canada, the incidence of TSD in the Jewish population has declined by more than 90% since the advent of genetic screening. On January 18, 2005, it was reported that as a Jewish disease, Tay-Sachs has almost been eradicated. Of the 10 babies born with Tay-Sachs in North America in 2003, none had been born to Jewish families. In Israel, only one child was born with Tay-Sachs in 2003, and preliminary results from early 2005 indicated that none were born with the disease in 2004. So that's a very encouraging result to this endeavor. And I met with about a week ago, I met with a few activists, some of them that have Tay-Sachs or other diseases, genetic diseases, which are common in the Jewish population, and they are working on doing something similar for the non-religious population, and they're trying to get the word out to get everyone screened so that before they finalize a marriage, they should know what their options are, and then if necessary, they can go ahead and do PGD with IVF. So that's only an introduction to what I really want to talk about, is what happens when a child is conceived and found to be carrying the disease, which is called Tay-Sachs. So this child will probably not live more than 4 years. At the age of 6 months, the deterioration will begin. And what happens if an abortion can be allowed or not? The Baal Shalosh Teshuvos Tzitz Eliezer is one of the famous poskim that dealt with medical issues in the last generation. It's famous, his psak, he was matter to do a termination of the pregnancy ad ha-chodesh ha-shvi'i shel hirayon, up to the end of the second trimester. But Rav Poskim disagree, and by Nahem, Shalosh Teshuvos Igros Moshe, Hagrashat Oyerbach, Va'od, and they do not feel that an abortion is allowed for a child that has Tay-Sachs. Rav Afalalo, you have a seat. Shavua Tov. Since the child can live a few years, although in a very compromised way of life, a very low quality of life, but nevertheless, we're not dealing with a trefa, or even less with a child that has no signs of life. The child is alive, and although he's suffering or he's severely impaired, this is not a ground, according to Roy Poskim, to allow an abortion. And the same would apply to the following diseases: when there's maternal rubella, German measles, Down syndrome, teratogenic drugs like the famous thalidomide babies, or hydrocephalus. And here's a tshuva of the Baal Shevet HaLevi Chelek Yud Siman Resh Nutet. He talks about a young woman that has three of her children died from a genetic disease. V'sheilato im efshar la'atir lehem la'asok hala b'fri urvu, means that they're asking, should they continue having children on the condition that if it would be found that the child is suffering from the genetic disease, it would be allow, it would be a mutter to do an abortion. And he paskened dati hu aniel, because they shalti kva harbe pa'amim, dimem krovim lelaide. If at the end of the pregnancy, in the third trimester, then it would be advised to wait until the woman gives birth, and meaning Hashem should take care of it. But if it's really early in the pregnancy and the child does not have any chance to live, he allows Meikar Adin to do an hapala. He allows a termination. So we have a psak here that allows terminating a pregnancy when we're dealing with a totally non-viable fetus, but again, there's no clear definition what, according to the Shevet HaLevi, is considered non-viable. I wanted to talk a few moments about this new technology, relatively new, it's about 15 years old, a pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. It's known by PGD. I remember when it was first announced, it was called PID, the pre-implantation diagnosis, but they changed it because PID stands for something else, I think. It's an inflammatory disease. Yeah, so it's now known by PGD. PGD, also known as embryo screening, refers to procedures that are performed on embryos prior to implantation, sometimes even on oocytes prior to fertilization. PGD is considered another way to prenatal diagnosis. When used to screen for a specific genetic disease, its main advantage is that it avoids selective pregnancy termination, as the method makes it highly likely that the baby will be free of the disease under consideration. And now with the advance in genetics, almost every genetic disease can be defined and a certain test prepared for it, so that the embryos can be screened for any known genetic mutation of the parents. Here's a diagram where one cell is plucked from the embryo, and this takes place. We see between day 4 and day 6, that's when PGD is done, when the embryos is 8 cell compacted marula, that's when the cell is taken out of this embryo and sent for genetic testing, so that by day 6 or day 5 or day 6, when the implantation has to take place, they already know which embryos are healthy, which embryos are defective. Here's another few images of blastomere biopsy, 8 cell embryo, where this single cell is plucked out of the embryo. It has no effect on the embryo itself. The embryo can still remain healthy, and then this is evaluated, and when the results come back, they pick out the healthy embryos, and those are transferred back to the uterus. So the question is it allowed for healthy people that have no infertility problems to go do IVF, Hafreya Chutz Gufit, in order to be able to screen out the unhealthy embryos and to have a healthy baby? Here it's written in Hebrew. The question is basically, IVF was developed to treat infertility, meaning those couples that cannot conceive naturally can go to IVF, although IVF is not lechatchile because it's an unnatural way of conceiving. Nevertheless, since they cannot conceive naturally, so of course they can go to IVF, in vitro fertilization. But people who are fertile, so they don't have a problem of infertility, and they can have natural conception, are they allowed to undergo IVF, which involves many, many halachic issues, in order to do PGD and to have healthy embryos? So the answer is positive. Rav HaPoskim, today's Poskim, allow doing IVF for the purpose of preventing a child having a genetic disease. And this is the psak of Hagdashaz Oyerbach, and the same Lahab Machaim Lachaim, Hagdash Eliyashev, the foremost Poskim in today's generation, and the Rav Vosner, and they all allow doing IVF and PGD for this purpose. Now, I had a very interesting ethical question which happened at the Royal Vic a few months ago, and the question was as follows, and I was involved in the ethical committee, and yes.
Just a clarification, they allow it even if they haven't had an abnormal baby, or only after they've had a...
It's no difference. If it's clear that the couple has a genetic disease, I don't know how they find out, because normally it comes to the fore only when they have
they know they're carriers, they have a clear carrier.
Okay.
So they know they're carriers, in that case they're allowed to do it.
Yes.
An example just that hasn't to do with the baby that's affected is recurrent pregnancy losses. So one of the workups we do is a karyotype on the parent. And sometimes you see a balanced translocation in one of the parents. So those are the ones that never have had a history of a genetic disorder, but just so that they don't keep having pregnancy losses, you would do a BCDD on those patients.
Yeah. Okay, here's the following case, a very interesting case. The following case was presented to the Ethics Committee of the Royal Vic. A Jewish Orthodox couple with four children here in Montreal. The couple are carriers of a gene which causes deafness with a 25% chance of inheriting the disorder. Two of the children are moderate to severe hearing impaired. And they would like to have PGD for genetic hearing defect. And this was presented, of course, to the Ethical Committee for approval. So the question is, can we go ahead with PGD to screen out hearing disorder, even though the condition is not life-threatening? And it was rejected. The Ethics Committee rejected their request, and the arguments offered were, number one, since deaf people can lead productive lives, screening those defective embryos would be an act of discrimination. And they said, they have a right to live just like their healthy siblings. How can we discriminate between embryos? And number three, the existing deaf children would be offended. They will find out that the parents subsequently prefer to have healthy babies, basically telling them that their lives aren't worth living. So these were the logic behind the decision of the Ethical Committee to reject their request. And of course, I can't tell you how the couple was devastated when they heard this decision. And to understand the background behind this logic is, of course, I'm sure that many of you have heard this debate. Deaf parents could choose to have deaf children. They can go to IVF and PGD to choose the defective embryos, and those should be transferred. Here's a quote from the paper. Disabled parents may be given the right to choose to have disabled children when a new genetic screening test becomes widely available, the PGD. The measure being considered now by government advisors would allow deaf parents to decide to have deaf children on the basis that it might be in the child's interest to be born with the same disability as their parents. And this has happened, and this is all over the world being debated. They want their children to be like they are, and they're deaf, they want the children also to be. It's a culture. It's not a defect, it's not a disability, and we have to respect everyone in our society. And the supporting arguments behind this are, supporters argue that certain disabilities such as deafness are so mild that it could be in the long-term interest of the child to have them, so that they will share the same experiences as their affected parents. But clearly, here's a quote from Professor Templeton, clearly there's a very real conflict between the parental desires and the welfare of the child, said Professor Templeton, head of obstetrics and gynecology at Hebridean University. So this, you make a search and you see there's a lot of literature on this. So this was probably in the back of their minds when they decided, hey, if deafness is something which we have to respect, and people can even choose to be deaf or to have deaf children, chas v'shalom, so why should we be the ones doing PGD to screen out and put aside or destroy the embryos which are deaf, which have the potential of becoming born as deaf? Deaf people, and only and return only the healthy ones. So these were the arguments. Of course, an appeal was. The couple appealed, and asked I appear at the hearing to argue for them. And at the hearing, we debated the issue, and countered the basis of the ruling with the following arguments. I said, according to Jewish law, an embryo is not alive yet; therefore, it's not afforded the same rights, meaning the right to live, equality, as a living human being. So there's no argument of discrimination here, because you're not discriminating between people. And number two, to create a disabled child just for the sake of preventing possible feelings of resentment of the siblings is simply wrong. I just didn't get it, man. I couldn't understand this the rationale behind it. But I think this was the winning argument. And then I asked the following question. If a pregnant woman would find out that the baby is hearing impaired and request an abortion, would her wish be granted? And the answer was an astonishing yes. So then I countered, if terminating a live baby is acceptable, how can you explain the refusal to allow the parents to prevent that pregnancy from occurring in the first place? And the ethicist responded, you know what, there's really no rationale to explain it, but this is an accepted societal norm. But they then saw that it doesn't make sense. So Baruch Hashem, so we see from here there's a fundamental difference between Jewish and general or secular ethics. The source of authority for the rules of moral behavior for Jewish medical ethics is, of course, the Torah. For secular medical ethics, the source is human understanding, which can never be totally objective. Contemporary societal norms play a major, if not a decisive, role in secular ethics, as our case clearly demonstrates. The case, Baruch Hashem, had a happy ending with the approval of our request, and the woman now, Baruch Hashem, pregnant with a healthy baby. So this is when it comes to PGD, and we're faced with sometimes obstacles which are simply not logical. Now let's go over to some problems which might be considered a non-viable fetus, allowing termination, allowing abortion or not. So this condition, acrania or anencephaly, is discussed quite extensively in the halachic literature. What is acrania? It's a cephalic disorder of the human fetus characterized by a partial or complete absence of the cranium. Cranium meaning the skull, the bone that covers the brain. Anencephaly is a cephalic disorder that results from a neural tube defect that occurs when the cephalic, the head end of the neural tube, fails to close, usually between the 23rd and 26th day of pregnancy, resulting in the absence of a major portion of the brain, skull, and scalp. Children with this disorder are born without a forebrain, the largest part of the brain, consisting mainly of the cerebral hemispheres, and the remaining brain tissue is often exposed, not even covered by bone or skin. So we're dealing with acrania and anencephaly. Acrania is in all cases lethal. No human being can live without a skull, and there is no technology today or in the future that will be able to maintain victims of this anomaly alive more for a longer time. The difference between acrania and anencephaly is that acrania is the absence of the cranium, but anencephaly is the absence of the brain, and the brain can still be formed in acrania. In encephaly, as we see on this diagram, on the right, there's no upper brain. Only the brainstem is there. On the left, we see a normal brain, and on the right, only the brainstem. The brainstem controls the automatic functions of the body, but there's no upper brain. Here's another diagram. There's no brain formation on the right, and only the brainstem is there. Anencephaly, a baby born with anencephaly is usually blind, deaf, unconscious, and unable to feel pain. Although some individuals with anencephaly may be born with a main brain stem, the lack of a functioning cerebrum permanently rules out the possibility of ever gaining consciousness. Reflex actions such as breathing and responses to sound or touch occur. So what about abortion? Anencephaly can often be, how is it diagnosed? Anencephaly can be often diagnosed before birth through an ultrasound examination. The maternal serum alpha fetal protein, AFP screening, and a detailed fetal ultrasound can be useful for screening for neural tube defects such as spina bifida or anencephaly. So what is the halucha when it comes to a fetus with anencephaly? Here I quote from Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach Zatzal. He writes, Nadalan Yizdati, the Vishaa Shuhu Rak Ubar, as long as it's still in utero, Ha'il ve'enu ra'ui lebriyat neshama, since this fetus is not possible after having a neshama, after having a life. V'gam l'achar shanoil is ayin imoy tumay elaydim shim dara avlad hu, it's not considered a vlad. L'chein efshar deshaper mutar lehorgo, mutar, it's allowed to do an abortion. V'lehimana miliois ummal v'yulat shukar. It's a quote from the scriptures. Ulam la'achar shekvar noilad v'gam kudu lo yichudushav, but after the child is born, mistaver kumo shekosu v'tshuva me'ahava, meaning that this child cannot be killed after he's born. If he's already born, we have to give him life support as long as he can live. But before he's born, the pregnancy can be terminated. And he adds, Umar li agon zatzal, she'im kolu lo yichudushav, if the child was born to term, Muter lechalelu levesa Shabbos gam b'isa Torah, meaning if the child is born and we have to be mechalel Shabbat to give him life support, although he has no viability, no chance of living, nevertheless, as long as he's alive, we have to do everything, including chilul Shabbat, to provide for his needs. B'chol oifen, im ha'tinok mafsik linshom, but if the child stops breathing, ein tzrichim lasos pulot hachia, resuscitation does not have to be given to such a child. And there's also a tshuva in Shevet HaLevi, Chelik Tet Simen Reish Samachvuz. He writes, "B'mikre Danon Didon." He's dealing with anencephaly. Adif mekolonal kivim the ubar vaday trife gumer al nezek hamoch ikrumav. Since there's such a massive damage to the brain and the brain krumim, the dura. The membranes around the brain. Barud the bekezei loy amru rishonim deike isur toira. There's no isur to do the abortion. Al kaim pashut betzuruf chashash sakana itzluem bevaday mutar. Mishum tzar gadol. And if the mother is in pain or distressed because of this pregnancy, hayoyt kevlad ainu bar kiyam aklal deike kamatzudim luku ain v'lav rafa. You don't mean he's not for sure if it should be allowed, but nevertheless. The accepted ruling is that if the woman chooses to terminate the pregnancy, it is allowed when we're dealing with anencephaly. And Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein also writes the same. A child that doesn't have a brain is similar to anevela, mutar lahapiloi. And then there's a quote from Rav Eliashiv saying that a vlad that tafui lamut tok lamed yom dinoi kenefel mutar lahapiloi. And this is already a broader ruling, not only in anencephaly. Any type of disorder which is clear that the child cannot live for 30 days, this allows termination of the pregnancy. And we'll use this ruling in the coming cases we're going to discuss. So what is the difference between mapelet guf atum, which is not considered viable at all, and therefore an abortion is allowed, and yoledet trifim in abeten, which we do not allow an abortion? So let's take a look at the source of this ruling. It's a Gemara in Masechet Nida, Chav Gimel Amud Beis. Umar Uve, v'eshtoi nukes, if there's a perforation in the esophagus, imoy tmayu, meaning that it's considered a birth and all the rules dealing with giving birth to a live baby apply. V'eshtoi atum, but if the veshet, the esophagus is sealed, meaning that
atresia,
or it's not even formed, there's a missing piece of the veshet, imoy tohiru, it's not even considered a live birth. And the Rambam writes, the Rambam adds even more disorders. Nivra veshet shaloi atum, o shaloi chaser mitaburo ulamata. From the navel and the towards the bottom of the body is missing. Harei hu atum. Oisha hoisu gilgautoi atuma. This is anencephaly. Oisha hoi panav tuchot. Ba'in bahen heker panim. The face is completely flat. You can't see a face. Oisha yeshlo shnei gabin. Two vertebrae. Vishtei shedrois. Two spinal columns. Oisha yipilu briyat rosha einu chatuch. That means that the head is not separate from the body, that it's one ein imoy tmei elayda. All these deformities are not considered live birth.
Can you go back to that?
Yes.
These are very different things. The things mentioned by the Rambam
are monstrous abnormalities really incompatible with life.
Mm-hmm.
The first is correctable. It's not the dual atresia today. That's a baby that will live with it.
So here's where medical science comes into play. Because if we're dealing with these anomalies which could not be treated, okay, then it's not considered life. But if today we can treat them, of course, that's why we have to ask what medicine has to say. And the Ramban, he develops this theory of inconsistent with life. The Ramban writes there in Nida, Natalie Shekola nulad betreifus, vada imoy temegohi. Because a treifa can live the 12 months. Shalok derech chayim means inconsistent with life. Such a blood, it's not similar, such a structural deformity that it's not consistent with life. And of course, this might change with the development of medicine, but this is an interesting definition. And the Chazon Ish also uses this definition. He writes, those are which are considered viable. So this is the distinction between consistent with life. He has his body might be diseased, he might have a genetic disease, but all his organs and the vital organs are there and they're functionable, therefore it's considered a treifa, which we cannot terminate. But if it's something which is inconsistent with life, it's abortion is allowed. So I think what we can learn from here is, let me finish this definition. We can see from this distinction that there's a difference between a life-threatening deformity, which might still be consistent with life, and a structural deformity which would be inconsistent with life. The severe deformations listed in the Gemara are examples of such anomalies. The practical application of this rule can be very tricky. And now we're going to take a look at a few such cases. Yes?
I just wanted to clarify, because you said, so we're going to be talking about things that are mamish inconsistent with life, that's not considered a treifa?
No, that's even less than treifa.
Okay, so I thought treifa, somebody told the treifa,
No, absolutely not. Maybe there's a plethora of capital punishment, but it's definitely also. Absolutely.
But it's not the same as murder.
No, it's not the same as a viable person. Yes.
Okay.
There's a difference, but nevertheless, it's definitely also. Yes. Okay, so treifa, there's a whole perek in Masechet Chulin which is called Elu Treifa. Now, the treifas are defects in the body, like a hole in the lung, a hole in the heart, a hole in the intestines, a missing limb, missing kidneys. There's a whole list. There are 18 major classes of treifa, and in this application, we're talking about what happens when a human being or a fetus has that type of problem. So that is considered. There's a machlokes in the Gemara: if treifa chaya or treifa eino chaya, can a treifa live? And it only applies to Hilchas Kashrut, or a treifa is the reason why a treifa cannot be eaten is because this animal cannot live. So there's a machloikah. So the maskuna is treifa ayno chaya. But the person can say it's not really applicable when it comes to human beings. But of course, every surgery today you cut into the heart, you cut into the intestines, and some people live. So the only real basis of allowing termination, an abortion, is when we're dealing with something which is not inconsistent with life. So let's take a look at a few issues which came up lately, which might fall into that category of inconsistent with life. Potter syndrome. Parosynquence, also known as Parosyndrome, syndrome, is the atypical physical appearance of a fetus or a neonate due to oligohydramnios, meaning there's not enough amniotic fluid in the pregnancy. Oligohydramnios is the decrease in amniotic fluid volume sufficient to cause disruptions in the morphogenesis of the fetus. Classic Parosynquence occurs when the developing fetus has bilateral renal agenesis, meaning the kidneys are undeveloped, which also presents with a genesis of the uterus. Ureters. Yeah. The fetus continues to eat. What is the problem with oligo and hydramnios? The fetus continuously swallows amniotic fluid, which is reabsorbed by the gastrointestinal tract and then reintroduced into the amniotic cavity by the kidneys via urination. Oligohydramnios occurs if the volume of the amniotic fluid is less than normal for the corresponding period of gestation, and the fetal urine is critical to the proper development of the lungs by aiding in the expansion of the airways, the alveoli. Here's a diagram of oligohydramnios. We can see small lungs, there's decreased amniotic fluid, hydronephrosis, meaning there's a swelling, there's accumulation of fluid in the kidneys, enlarged kidneys, enlarged bladder, and club feet. This is oligohydramnios.
It is a part of the issue is, I think what they're pointing right off the bladder, you see a little band there. That's probably posterior retro valve because Potter's sequence is a classic is when they don't have a kidney.
Uh-huh.
If a baby has kidneys and an enlarged bladder, it's probably a boy with an obstruction of the bladder. That's why that's so big.
Mm-hmm.
It dilated the ureter.
So this is not Potter's.
Potter's is whenever you don't have fluid and you have a bunch, the Potter's sequence, you have a bunch of problems because the baby doesn't have fluid.
Mm-hmm.
You see the very small lungs, but the cause of the Potter's in here is because there's no...
There's a blockage. Another development from this sequence is pulmonary hypoplasia. If the alveoli and thereby the lungs are underdeveloped at the time of birth, the infant will not be able to breathe air properly and will go into respiratory distress shortly after birth due to pulmonary hypoplasia, underdeveloped lungs. This is the primary cause of death to Potter sequence infants, secondary to renal failure. So the case we had, and now I'm quoting from Dr. Oppenheim, echogenic kidneys in context of an absent bladder and hydramnios makes this a lethal malformation. This fetus may survive to birth, but will certainly not live. And this malformation is clearly not compatible with neonatal life and is considered an FL, and thus can be aborted. So this was the conclusion when we had this case some time ago. So here we have one instance of a severe malformation which is not consistent with life.
So Nephil
is a child that's born that dies before 30 days. And even the parents do not have to sit Shiva because it's not considered, he was never alive. Pentalogy of Cantrell, which my two friends were involved lately. So here's the description. There are multiple malformations. Specifically, there's a large amphelocele ventral wall defect which is extensive and includes intestines, liver, bladder, components of the heart, which altogether is suggestive of a pathology of control. Furthermore, there are musculoskeletal defects with spine involvement and dislocated pelvis, hips, and club feet. And here's Dr. Ziegler's opinion. The amniocentesis reveals a normal chromosomal analysis, but this does not preclude the fact that these multiple abnormalities may be part of a genetic syndrome incompatible with extrauterine life. At the moment, the mother's health is not being compromised in any way. My intuition, given the bias I have seen, having done her first ultrasound and having seen the severity of the abnormalities, would be to recommend termination of the pregnancy. And then we ask Dr. Oppenheim's opinion, and here's his report from the ultrasound he did. Is it clear? So he found a single intrauterine pregnancy which measures 3 weeks earlier than the menstrual date, an early ultrasound. Multiple malformations are identified. The head appears normal. Abdominal wall, there's a large amphelocele which contains liver, intestines, lower portion of the heart, bladder, and what resembles a kidney. The limbs are all seen. The left leg has sphere clubbing. The right leg protrudes from the posterior aspect of the pelvis, completely different, malformed. There's a bladder extrophy and so that's... Okay, so you can read this whole explanation. So let's see what his conclusions are. I've explained these findings to Hannah and her mother, and although the karyotype is normal, the constellation of these findings are suggestive of a genetic syndrome, possibly a pathology of Cantrell, which incurs upon the fetus a very poor prognosis, likely one that's not compatible with life. A consultation with genetics to further discuss this with Hannah is suggested, should doubt of the management exist. Hannah will discuss this further with Dr. Ziegler today. So this was the ultrasound report. And he wrote me, Dr. Avnai wrote me, I believe that given the 3-week size discordance, it's likely that the fetus will die on its own, in utero. However, this is not certain. I don't feel this is compatible with life without extensive surgical repair, of which a prognosis is very guarded and likely not to even considered unless under experimental conditions. So the couple was referred to genetic counseling, and their conclusions were quite different. So, Chaim, would you explain what happened?
So the only reason I sent her there, I mean, I think Dr. Ziegler saw the same malformation earlier. I saw it at 20 weeks, so I can see much more. And Dr. Ziegler operated at 15 weeks. To put it into perspective, this baby was very malformed. An omphalocele is an abdominal wall defect, which means that the abdominal wall, which is supposed to close along the midline, didn't close. And the peritoneum is intact, and it's really outside of the abdomen. Now, an isolated omphalocele, which is just the abdomen, is usually correctable, very correctable defect. In this case, however, it extended up to the thorax. The heart was part out, and it went really low down to the pelvis where the bladder was out, and that's what we call a pathology of Cantrell, and it really has a poor prognosis because most of the body is out, and the rest of the body doesn't develop properly because there's no need for it to grow because everything just grows on the outside. On top of that, there was a problem with the pelvis, which I think it was dislocated. We couldn't see very well, but one of the legs, I don't remember which one, came out of the back. So it's completely dislocated, protruded out of the back, had some clubbing, and the spine was 90 degrees if you looked at it on a sagittal view. It was a lordosis 90 degrees, and if you looked at it from the back, it was really shaped as a pronounced S. So what that will result in, the lungs usually won't grow normally, so when the baby comes out, we'll essentially have a pulmonary hypoplasia. She had an fetal echo, so we sent her to genetics pretty much to corroborate. Now, what ended up happening, genetics did a literature search and found that if you have an omphalocele with some musculoskeletal defects, this is a certain syndrome that someone has described and has suggested that there's a 70% survival to this, which was very disturbing for us because, well, 70% of those babies that they probably elected to continue the pregnancy, because no doctor in their right mind who sees this will tell a patient that this is compatible with life, let alone any normal life. So,
and what did the surgeon say to it?
So I spoke to the geneticist yesterday afternoon. They sent the baby for a cardiac echo to see if there's anything wrong structurally with the heart, which looked pretty normal to me, except the fact that it wasn't in the chest. It had a normal, small minor detail, normal four chamber, outflows were normal, no septal defects, nothing wrong with the outflow tract. So they said it's a normal heart, and then she met with a surgeon. The surgeon gave some interesting advice. He said, well, in isolation, an omphalocele we can correct. If there was a heart defect, we could correct that. If there was a skeletal defect, club feet, we can correct that, but this is very extensive. But maybe we can correct it. So genetics is going to meet again with the family this week. It's always hard, I know, when I'm faced with this, to give a definitive answer to someone and say it's not compatible with life. That's why, just like the second or first or second slide, or why you get a second opinion, or a case like this, you like to get a second opinion, but I think what was presented to this couple, this family, may not really be reflective, and I fear that they're going to send them on an expedition of trying to save a baby. When this baby's going to come out, if it lives, I don't think it will live in utero, but if it does live, I think it'll just be a very unfortunate thing, and they're going to go through, no one's going to bother correcting it. I don't know what you think, please.
I can't really add anything to the medical part. In addition to all the medical issues here, and there won't be any breach of confidentiality, this is to whom it's happens also factors into the equation a little bit in terms of an attitude. So it's sort of a perfect storm in that way.
Meaning that if this child is born?
Well, it's being born to not to just to anybody, in a sense. I mean, every parent is precious, every human is, but this is a very unusual case, an extra layer.
I agree. I think I was telling you, I don't think their level of understanding is very, very high. You know, it's
that
all...
Is,
yeah, but why should this be a factor in deciding if the child could be terminated or not?
Because if they give them some hope, they will think that this baby could live, and I think the rational part of this, you really are dealing with something that's lethal. Sure, we might correct this, we might correct. Don't hang on to that, we might do it in all isolation. This is a very...
No, I have to add here, this couple is waiting for my decision. They're not going to build on hope, or more hope or less hope. If the halakha says the termination should be done, it's going
to
be done.
So, just to add on that, you know, another thing the genetic counselor told me, that there's someone in New York who told them if the baby will come out with a pulse and could be alive, you can't terminate it. So I'm like, well, before she does that, we'll get our expert here to give her an opinion. But someone has suggested that.
Okay, so I don't know.
I don't know anything about the pentology potential. Intrauterine death is still a good possibility.
Especially that there's
a three-week
discordance, the 20 weeks when you see an IUGR that early. And the problem with this is that this baby, because it's in utero, might keep living. You know, it gets oxygenated through the mother. With that extensive spine deformity, you can't expect those lungs to grow. So when the baby will come out, it won't be able to breathe and oxygenate itself.
So, yes?
There's a certain wisdom in the rigorous halachic approach to you know, condoning abortion. We often put parents in very difficult positions of making this decision, and I think there's a certain genius in being very strict about the criteria, because often God takes care of it. The parent is never burdened with the lifelong memory of having made the decision to terminate a baby. It just happens.
Mm-hmm.
It's very different. Unfortunately, a lot of prenatal diagnosis puts parents in that position.
Mm-hmm.
So, to wait may not be unwise. As long as the mother is at no inherent risk physically, and she's not so far, I don't think that's a completely unreasonable approach.
To what? To wait?
To wait.
Yeah. And let nature take care of it.
We also allow babies to die in labor that haven't died up until that point.
See, because of this skeletal deformity and the leg, one behind the head, this baby may present as a transversal leg. What are you going to do then? We could be faced with a phone call one night and then it walks in, transverse line.
I'm not sure if that's the discussion for this.
Let me give you my feeling about this problem. My feeling is, if they will ask for my opinion, my feeling is that this is not consistent with life. These massive deformations are not consistent with life. And although some surgical intervention can be experimented and tried to give this child some semblance of life, this is really similar to these deformations which are mentioned in Chazal and Rambam. And therefore, if the family wishes to do so, they have a heter to do an abortion. Okay, let's go on. Now, what about a child that's born with a cranium or an encephaly and the organs are needed? Should dying babies be organ donors? As many as half of the approximately 1,500 children waiting for organ transplant each year die before donors can be found. The shortage of donors has led to calls for permitting organs of children born with the birth defect and encephaly to be donated before the children die. The issue has proved controversial. As doctors and medical ethicists debate the legality and morality of allowing the harvesting of organs from a person who is not legally dead. And there's a very famous tshuva in the Sefer Tshuva Me'ahava. This was printed about 250 years ago. And he talks about a deformed baby, which, when we look at the description, is very clearly he's talking about an encephaly. הנה מראיתו וצורתו הוא כאשר אספר על ראשו עומד כמי נזר גדול ואדום, like a crown, a red crown, והעיניים עומדים על מצחו למעלו, and the eyes are at the top of the forehead. מלא אש ואימה פחד גדול. Everyone was frightened to see this. פיהו עקום תחת העיניים, מיד לחיוב כאגמן רביני משונה ובשאר גוף אדם. Completely deformed. So the skull is similar to an encephaly. And the question posed to this Poisek was, in mutar lahamit havlad, if the child can be put to death. The description sounds like classical anencephaly. And his maskone was, והוא נחצה והוא סלקה חלילה לשם אדם לשלוח יד לפגוע לסבב סיבה וגרום להמית הבלד הזה ובכלל שפיכות דמים הוא ועושה כן הוא אויץ נגד חוקי אלוקים ותורתו. Meaning a child is born with anencephaly cannot be terminated. Murder. So that's what he's saying. Although his organs might be needed, but since he's alive, since he's already born, you cannot shorten his life. And the same is the Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes, "Bishur shurak ubar, as long as he's in utero, hol ve'ene ruel briat neshama ve'gam la'achar shanolad ene mutmai leide, v'chein efshad shapa muta lahorgoi v'lehim mana." I quoted that before. He can be aborted. V'lam la'achar shekvar noilad v'gam kudu lechadushuv. After he's born and he was born at term, mistaber k'moy shekusu v'tshuva mahava, that his life cannot be taken. A few words about multi-fetal pregnancy reduction, dilul ubarim. Yes.
I'm trying to think, you know, we are 100% accurate in the prenatal diagnosis of anencephaly. Nobody misses that. Even an amateur, you wouldn't miss it.
Mm-hmm.
So, can you remember a mother who elected not to terminate an anencephalic in the past? So it's a very theoretical question about keeping this baby, I think, the term for organs, because I'm unaware of a single mother who, given that information, has said, I'm carrying this baby to term, in my experience in these 20 years.
Yeah,
we deliver an anencephaly.
There are there could be situations where a woman comes to term, not had an ultrasound, and therefore needs to be present with herself.
But that wouldn't be the dilemma, because that would be murder. We're not talking about keeping a fetus alive to harvest its organs, we're just talking murdering a live.
Okay, but you know, the today's world is not so is concerned about that.
Yeah.
No, it slipped out. Okay. How do I do it? I have to turn it off. Oh, here it is. Dilul ubarim. Multi-fetal pregnancy reduction. Selective reduction or fetal reduction is a form of abortion, specifically the practice of reducing the number of fetuses in a multi-fetal pregnancy, those involving more than one fetus. With selective reduction, one or more fetuses are selected for termination. If the mother's life is in danger, each fetus is a rodef and can be terminated to save the mother. But if the danger is to the various fetuses and not to the mother, each fetus is an aggressor and a victim with equal rights, status. It therefore might not be permissible to put aside one for the sake of the other. So this is a borderline question. When it's clearly a danger to the mother, no question. But what happens when we leave all four in or all five in, some might die. So how do we decide? Can we terminate or reduce the pregnancy?
What if all may die as a result of leaving them in?
Okay. Yeah, that question is similar.
But it's not similar, because in one situation, if one is going to kill the other, so at least one will win and one will leave the war.
Mm-hmm.
In another situation, you'll have no life.
Correct.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so that's even easier to allow. But what happens when, from these five, only two will stay alive? So how do you choose and how do you decide to terminate one to save the other? In Sefer Nishmas of Rumi, brings down from Rav Auerbach, Shedate noite lahatir, hariges chelek ma'ubarim kedei lahatzil et hanotarim. He allows terminating some of them to save the others. So Rav Zilberstein explains that our case concerns fetuses, all of which are already condemned to die. Multi, like Dr. Portnoy said, multi-fetal pregnancy reduction should therefore be allowed, he rules, noting that this might then be a case of fetal life-saving rather than fetal reduction. This reasoning seems to assume that without MPR, none of the fetus will survive the multiple pregnancy. It would suggest that if the medical indication is that they would survive, albeit with serious physical or other mental deficiencies, MPR might be prohibited. But the conclusion in general is that the consensus appears to be that MPR is ethically permissible, provided that the minimum number of fetuses are terminated to ensure a good prognosis for the mother and the remaining fetuses. Determining the number is a medical rather than halachic decision. So in general, the approach is positive, that fetal reduction is allowed when it's clear that there's a danger to at least part of the fetuses. Yes?
You know, this is a little tricky because where do you draw the line? A lot of people will offer reduction in triplets. And triplets, you can take them to 32 weeks on average. And so people will say, well, if you reduce it from 3 to 2, your prognosis is far better, and you can go to 37 weeks on average, as opposed to triplets, which are 32.
And 32 weeks is premature, but it's a danger?
I mean, it's a baby.
Mortality in all hospitals for 32 weeks is zero.
Less than 5%.
Actually zero. It's actually zero.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In our place, it's actually zero.
So the prognosis is really good. The only issue is people will tell you, well, intact survival maybe there's higher. You're not talking about real mortality rates.
And the reduction itself is not risky?
It carries a 6% risk of losing everything.
Everything. Okay, so 6 is more than 5. You said that having them at 32 weeks is only 5% mortality.
Yeah. But they don't see it that way. I mean, it's a very accepted thing to reduce from 3 to 2. In fact, some people will reduce from 3 to 1.
Okay, that's not for medical reasons. I think it's more for convenience reasons.
Well, you know, twins, there's more problems with twins. You can see diabetes to the mother and hypertension. So, in California, in fact, I actually did a study. In California, people reduce from 2 to 1 because they don't want twins. So, where do you draw the line? I think I can accept when it's 5 bring them to 3 or 4 bring them to 3. But to go from 3 to 1 and then... Medically, what they do, and this was a question I think we've discussed, where you're not supposed to select out the fetus. You go with the easiest access. However, people, what they'll do, they'll look at, the nuchal translucency and say, well, one's a little thicker than the other. Maybe this one is not as good, so let me try to select out that one.
So we discussed this before about selecting embryos.
Yeah.
So selecting live fetuses is definitely discriminatory. Against the Bill of Rights. Okay, we'll leave it at this. Any questions? Yes.
I just have one question, and that is the issue with the TGD. Because we're now getting into a situation where it's not just a question of picking out the gene but rather you could have a choice of how the fetus actually going to be.
Okay, that's definitely unethical.
It's 100% unethical, but I wonder in terms of, like, because we still don't consider, let's say, the fertilized egg as a living type of individual, what would be the attitude that people would have from a halakhic perspective to doing something like that?
Halakhically, we agree that doing PGD for the reason of sex selection or characteristic selection, or as they call it, designer babies, is definitely unethical. And it's a very slippery slope, which we don't want to be there. But when we're dealing with medical issues, and as I mentioned before, I take issue with this saying that a deaf person is not disabled. Maybe it's not politically correct to call him disabled, but it's definitely not something we want our children to be. So if this couple wants to prevent that from happening, I think it's absolutely it should be done. And there's another a bit controversial issue when it comes to PGD. Those people that are infertile, many times they have a genetic disorder which is called Klinefelter syndrome. Now, they would like to know that this male embryo they have doesn't have Klinefelter syndrome, because otherwise that child is also going to be infertile. I mean, they want to choose healthy embryos. So here we're dealing with a medical genetic problem which has nothing to do with health, because a Klinefelter syndrome person is very healthy. So here it's already a bit a question, but the Poiskim allow doing PGD to screen out Klinefelter syndrome too, because it's a medical problem and medical problems justify PGD.
One comment about what's the difference between medical and halakha. There's a lot of consistency in halakha. The big inconsistency that you have today is that anyone can walk into any abortion clinic at any time and have an abortion. And now here, an ethical committee can say, no, you can't do PGD for a hearing. It makes no sense. You can go, and we've had people who had, I've seen this myself because I remember being involved with this, a couple had two girls, and they didn't want another girl, they wanted a boy. They waited till we were able to tell them at 15 weeks what it was a girl, and they terminated it. This isn't a hearing defect, this is gender. And we see it also, one couple, it came to our prenatal meeting for fetal diagnosis, a cleft palate. And they terminated for a cleft palate because it was a girl, and they felt that if it's a girl that has a repair of a cleft palate, that it's, you know, it bothered them enough that they wanted, and there was no issue. She went off.
But PGD wouldn't be allowed for cleft palate.
Right, so that inconsistency makes no sense. Halakhically, fortunately, we have that there's this consistency, and it's not as bothersome. Where I don't understand why an ethical committee would say an issue with the hearing defect, but it's okay. Once she is pregnant, just abort it.
As you just said, that sex selection is now legal because you conceive. You have an ultrasound, and you decide
abort.
Yeah.
But sex selection by PGD is criminal in Canada. 4 years. So that doesn't make sense. It simply doesn't make sense. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you.